unfortunately, I'm seeing this as one of those unfortunate situations that I don't see a statute violation. I don't know if anybody else has any kind of opinions on that.
I have enough conflicting stories to at least hear from the other side, because, and I know I've read the materials and narratives and that kind of stuff, but what I would say is, you have a dog that comes in with a concern of bloat. It has pretty classic signs of bloat, in my opinion. Vomiting foam, vomiting liquid, not vomiting food, even though you know it ate the night before. Distension, mild distension, a big chested dog. I can't get more classic than that. And so to me, I'm sitting here going, how well was this dog really triaged? I don't know. I can't really get a good gauge of that from what was submitted. But more so than that, why would an owner decline x-rays when they're there at an emergency clinic ready to pay a bill and they authorize everything else? Yeah. And if they did decline it because they didn't understand, then who had the conversation with them on how important it is for these to happen? Because there was no reason for that. So to me, I'm like, I'm kind of leaning more on the side of the owner here and wanting to hear more.
I'd be definitely fine raising this to informal. I mean, we do see a lot of times where hindsight is, I should have approved it in the beginning, and it was offered, and it says it was declined initially, too. So yeah. I said, where is that confliction? But it says it was offered, and it's in the record.
We've got
we'll have to look at that.
We've got an owner very, very stressed.
Yeah.
They bring this treatment plan to them, and there's a semantics problem there. They go, treatment, they're going to treat the dog. I don't know, wait a minute, slow down. Where it should be in a diagnostic plan. Give them a diagnostic plan or a treatment plan or an estimate. Don't say it's a treatment plan with diagnostics on it when they're stressed out and they don't understand. Yes. So I agree with Dr. Jane. It sounds to me like this... this owner would not, with all that eventually was done, including surgery, would have declined radiographs at any point. And then I have other issues regarding the triage, common mildly distended due to splenomegaly. That screams bloat to me. Dr. Howe said, I feel splenomegaly on the right side, and that bothered her. Okay, spleen's not supposed to be on the right side. There was no written treatment plan that I saw. Verbally, this three-view radiographs were supposedly declined. So, another thing that bothered me, there was no direct communication between the respondent and the complainant at this time. And if there had been early on, it's like, meeting of the mind, radiographs. Okay, there wasn't. There was this go-between the staff, and here's what's happening. So that bothered me. Go talk to them, and the two of you together will probably end up with radiographing stuff. So this ER system of triage to assign an order when a patient, I think that works fine until it doesn't.
Well, I think it works fine if you're telling a technician to go in and explain what's going on, and the technician's doing that, and the owner's in agreement, and you're moving forward. But when things come to a standstill because there's a decline of something that doesn't really make sense, or there's a question, or there's a whatever, if it's not moving forward, then at that point you need to step in.
Right.
You need to step in and say, hey, help me understand. We're worried about what's going on. We want to make sure this isn't emergent. We need x-rays to determine that. Like, somebody needed to have that conversation.
Yeah. I do want to address, though, that, by statute, you can't have a verbal or a signed estimate as long as it's documented in there. And we are not under the mandates, on the human side, where we have to provide emergency care regardless of payment. If something is declined, we're under no state requirement that we have to proceed.
Sure.
So I understand what you're saying, but we're also, like I said, if an owner says no, I mean, how long are we going to argue in an emergency situation? And, I mean, that's a very difficult thing. It's like either do it or don't in some of those situations. So I do understand what you're saying, and I would be fine taking this to a informal, but it's just I don't see a true statute violation here. I think there's going to be maybe concern, but I don't even see a way to a level of our letter of concern. But it kind of ultimately falls down to the owner has to take the responsibility under statute that we offer the stuff. If they say no, we can't do anything else.
I don't know that we know that it was offered. That's, we have one person saying it was and one person saying it wasn't. We can't say that it was offered. You can say you looked in the medical record, but there are things in medical records that didn't happen. You have to judge based on testimony who you believe. And
I agree.
Right now, I'm believing the owner, but that might be because the veterinarian is not here.
Right. Yeah, no, that's it, yeah.
So we have a, you made a motion.
So, no, I did not make any kind of motion at this point.
So do you want to make a motion? Someone want to make a motion?
Yeah, someone wants to make a motion. It sounds like there's more concern.
I'll make a motion that we move this to informal.
Second. A motion and a second to move case 2455 to an informal. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you for being here. And we are now up to number 4, 2448, in regards to Kelsey Hall, CVM. Let me just read the case summary.
Case 2448, the complaint is Caroline McAdam. Respondent is Kelsey Hall, DVM. On July 15, 2023, Dante, a 12-year-old male domestic short-haired cat, was presented to respondent for lethargy, anorexia, and weight loss. Blood work was performed, and the cat was provided supportive treatment until blood results were obtained. The cat improved slightly. Blood results revealed mild changes in elevated pancreatitis indicators. Respondent had concerns for an underlying issue. On July 19, 2023, the cat was presented to respondent for treatment as the cat's condition was regressing. The cat was foaming at the mouth when provided the oral medication. After evaluation, repeat of supportive treatment and administered to the cat, an ultrasound was recommended and an appointment with an ultrasonographer was scheduled for August 7, 2023. On July 22, 2023, complainant reported that the cat was coughing and foaming at the mouth. Staff recommended the cat be taken to an emergency facility for care as they have ultrasound capabilities and respondent was not available. The next morning, the cat was presented to an emergency facility. The cat was examined and a brief ultrasound found pleural and peritoneal effusion and an enlarged kidney. Heart failure and neoplasia was discussed as possibilities. Treatment versus euthanasia was discussed. Complainant elected to humanely euthanize the cat. And the committee concluded that no violation of the Veterinary Practice Act occurred. It was moved and seconded. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize, I think I initially believed that the respondent was here, but it looks like just Mr. Stoll is monitoring, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we do not have the complainant here either. And Dr. Wright, you are again the lead on that one.
Yeah, so again, going through this, my one thought was what would take so long for the ultrasound to come in? I mean, that's a long time to schedule out an ultrasound for a sick animal. So that's kind of what my thoughts are around there. Beyond that, I agree with the investigative committee. The effusion can occur very, very quickly in cats, and that's a very hard thing. We had a pro-BNP that was done that didn't show any major issues. So diagnostic-wise, I don't see any failings in this. It was a progressive disease that finally kind of showed what was truly going on. But yeah, my major concern is the judgment call around the ultrasound, pushing it out that far.
Yeah.
And is that a concern, or is that kind of like, well, that's just scheduling and that's all it is? But I can usually get them done a lot quicker than that.
I agree, and if depending on how the cat presented and how serious this case was, we're going to schedule it some days out. Mm-hmm. So that to me also says, well, why not radiograph?
Yeah.
You're not going to ultrasound why don't we take a radiograph? And there may have been developed some. Mm-hmm. Signs of developing effusion. So that I zeroed right in on that too.
Yeah.
Why don't we radiograph?
Yeah.
Just radiograph.
Yeah. If we can't get it that long, we need to do something in the intermission or the inner.
Well, with cat. Yeah. I don't know why they didn't radiograph in the original at the beginning of this either.
Yeah. I mean, we had concerns of heart. I mean, we didn't have the testing for it. So why was nothing done if nothing else could be? So, yeah, that's kind of my concern there, is that elevating it to an informal to kind of seek more information. I don't think that's necessarily a wrong thing there. So I would make a motion to move this to an informal to seek more information.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to move this case 2448 to an informal. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passed. Okay, sorry. The motion passes. one day. Okay, we are now on our two-pack. Number 6, 2450 in regards to Reagan Chambers DVM, and then 2451 in regards to Kenneth Skinner DVM. I was going to call you Tracy. Annalise.
The front loads are pretty much the same, except okay. 51, the respondent is the responsible lender.
Okay.
Case 2450, Jamie Garcia is the complaint. Respondent is Reagan Chambers, DVM. On August 17th, 2023, Daisy, an 11-month-old, female German Shorthair Pointer, was presented to respondent for spay and front dew claw removal. Spay and front dew claw removal procedures were performed, and the dog was discharged to the owner later that day. On August 27, 2023, the dog was presented to Sarah Glenn DVM for possible infection of the dew claw sites, which was due to the patient having access to the incision sites. Dr. Glenn cleaned the dew claw sites, applied a new bandage, and dispensed antibiotics. Complaint declined purchasing bandage material from the premises, so a list of supplies was offered. On September 1st, 2023, the dog was presented to Premier Pet Hospital for possible suture removal. Dr. Gordon Ferguson advised complaint to recheck in 10 days to evaluate incision sites, and then the sutures would be removed. On September 8th, 2023, the dog presented to Dr. Ferguson for suture removal. The dew claw sutures were removed. And for 2450, the committee concluded that no violations of the Veterinary Practice Act occurred. It was moved and seconded, and the motion was approved with a vote of 4-0. And for case 2451, the respondent is Kenneth Skinner, DVM. And the committee concluded that possible violations of the Veterinary Practice Act occurred. It was moved and seconded to find ARS 3222-3212 as it relates to R311-11. In his role as the responsible veterinarian for the premises, there was no failure to provide courteous verbal or written interchange to the pet owner. The pet owner was not advised he was terminated from the premises and had future appointments scheduled. The motion was approved with a vote of 3-1.
Right. Thank you. Okay, so we've got Mr. Dahlstrom is here for the case 2450, correct?
No. It's stall 451.
Okay, so, and then it looks like we do have Dr. Skinner is not here.
As well.
What's that?
Dr. Skinner as well.
Okay, great. And then I do have the complaint here as well. So if Dr. Skinner would like to come forward. Thank you both for being here. You can state your name for the record, and then I can give you up to 5 minutes to address the board.
I'm Dr. Kenneth Skinner.
David Stoll, appearing as legal counsel for Dr. Skinner.
Thank you. Go ahead.
As I stated in my response, I've never provided any veterinary care to Mr. Garcia's dog, Daisy. In fact, I've never even seen the dog. Similarly, I've never spoken to Daisy's owner or Mr. Garcia's mother, and I therefore fail to see how the investigative committee can recommend a violation of RS 11501, which is failing to provide courteous verbal or written interchange to the pet owner. I haven't had any interaction with either of them. Although I had no direct interaction with the owner, I was involved with the decision to terminate the client. Obviously, the complaint had filed this response, this report, because of that termination of the client. The Veterinary Practice Act, RS 11-5017, says that veterinarians are free to choose whom the veterinarian will serve. The practice therefore has a right to terminate with the client, as they did on August 29th. The situation became very difficult with the owner. The owner, during multiple follow-up phone calls by staff, was very irate and refused to come in for recheck exams. When he did come in for a recheck exam, he arrived with no appointment and demanded to be seen and then also did not want to do the care that was recommended. Management ended up going in the exam room with him on that day where he forcefully told them to leave the exam room, and he would finish with the veterinarian. In advance of the review hearing, I've submitted the letter from the hospital director, Nancy Roble, advising him that we feel it's best for him, for all, that he find a new veterinarian for his current and future services. The letter is professional and courteous, and Ms. Roble included copies of the medical records to the owner to take to their new veterinarian. Consistent with that, Mr. Garcia did not show up for a suture removal appointment that was scheduled. If he had gone somewhere else for veterinary care, he had no future contact with us. Instead of going somewhere else, Mr. Garcia showed up unannounced after he received the letter, and he acknowledged the letter through an email without an appointment. He demanded to be seen. We tried to squeeze him in and told him he would wait where he became irate, difficult in the lobby, was advised by the front desk, the CSR management, that we would no longer provide him services and that he could go, and was given information to go to an emergency clinic or another practice. Also, it is important to remember, to the committee noted, that it is not, that this was not emergency care, that the pet's welfare and health was not compromised in any way in the termination of his client. He was waiting, he had a suture removal that he didn't show up for. We would not or never have terminated clients in this situation where pet's veterinary care would be compromised. In fact, it's extremely rare for us to fire or terminate a client ever. In my 23 years, I can remember twice. That this has happened. So it's not something we take lightly, and the right to terminate is only used in these extreme cases. In closing, I respectfully disagree with the committee's suggestion that either myself as the responsible veterinarian were in fact unprofessional or violated any ethical codes of the state practice act. I fully understand the requirements surrounding courteous and professional client communication in written and verbal communication. In fact, I'd like to remind you that the reason we fired him was his own verbal abuse, demanding and threatening behavior that caused him to be terminated as a client. In that regard, I recognize my honor and duty as a professional, and I recognize the obligation to protect my employees from harassment and abuse, and stand behind the decision that we made to exercise our right under the ethical code RS 11-501-7 to discontinue our relationship. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Step back. We do have Jamie Garcia that is here. Good morning, Mr. Garcia. Thank you for being here today. I can give you up to 5 minutes to address the board.
So that was a complete fallacy. That was just told. A week after Daisy had her dew claws removed, let me start at the very beginning. She was given two Elizabethan collars. One she chewed off completely and entirely, and it was based at the 12 and 6 positions of the clock. Because of that, they had recommended putting on a second one. So, you know, if it failed once, why try it again? They advised me to keep the bandages on her dew claw sites that were removed and to change the bandages every day until it was time for the suture removal. I started to smell something a week after. Removed the bandages as I had done every single day. Saw that one of them had busted open. There was no access to this. There was the bandages and everything that they had recommended. She had no access to this at all whatsoever. Then, called them on Thursday, said, hey, got a problem. I'm smelling something. It's oozing. Looks to be infected. Their person at the front desk said, send us a picture so that way you don't come in here for no reason, and we have to charge you for it. Took a picture, sent it in. They came back and said, well, it looks like it's just puffy from the surgery. Okay. Tell you what, if it comes back Saturday where it's still having issues on August 26th, we'll get her in, no problem whatsoever. Called them on Saturday afternoon, said, still smelling, still fussy, need to bring her in. We don't have time for you, is what their response was. We can bring you in on Sunday. I agreed, brought her in Sunday, saw Dr. Glenn. She said, it is infected. There is an infection, and it's so close to the knuckle that it is now becoming a very serious problem. And and because it became such a serious problem, they gave me medication for it. Completed the 10 rounds of medication, completed 5 rounds of medication. September 1st, brought her in. Amy was at the front desk along with Race, and they both had said, you're no longer welcome here. Your dog can no longer receive services here. Even though my dogs, both dew claws, were infected. They didn't care. None whatsoever. They said they sent a letter. Never got one. Even though a previous patient, my mom's previous dog, their vet tech had come because they had forgotten to take blood for another dog that had passed away. They had been to the residence. They knew where I lived. They had the address. They never received a letter, still haven't received the records today, Daisy's records from Prescott Animal Hospital. Premier Pet Hospital, she just had her rabies, her parvo, and her distemper boosters this past Saturday. They still don't have her records. They've called over there I don't know how many times, still don't have the records. They did not care that my dog still had an infection. And you're talking from August 27th to September 1st. Nothing. No written communication, no verbal communication, no nothing. From Amy, Nancy, Race, Dr. Chambers, Dr. Skinner, nothing. True, Dr. Skinner never saw Daisy. We never had any contact. We never had any communication whatsoever. But as the leading vet of the premises, he's solely responsible for what happens with his staff. And as you heard himself say himself, he decided to terminate my dog from the premises. It was not even the fact that he was terminating my dog. My mom offered to take my dog in there, and they said, she's not an owner. She can't bring the dog in. You and your dog are both terminated. Didn't matter with the infection. Didn't care. Took her to Dr. Ferguson. We were able to get everything under control. The infection was cleared, thank God. Sorry, nobody shares my faith. I apologize for that. And what he did was he got her in immediately. So the day that Dr. Skinner and his team terminated Daisy from Prescott Animal Hospital, again, if nobody shares my faith. By the grace of God, we were able to get her into Premier Animal Hospital in Prescott Valley, and he was able to squeeze her in, put the e-collar at the 2, 4, 8, and 10 position so she couldn't push it against against anything and chew on it. He advised us, take the bandages off. They're not, it's festering. That's what's causing your infection. The air is what needs to clean it out. And so, aside from all of that as well, I showed up September 1st. I took time off of work. My mom was willing to take her in, take time off of work. We were told by Nancy, Amy, and Race, don't come in here, or you will be trespassed. So.
Thank you.
That's it.
Thank you. You may step back. And Dr. James, you're the lead on this, so you can take them however you would like.
I think I'll take them separately. I think at $24.50 makes sense to start with. And in $24.50, I mean, I think from the medical records and the narratives and things that happened, I think the medical care provided was good. Ultimately, there was a infection, but I don't see anything in that visit that is what we're really here to discuss. And so I would support the investigative committee findings of no violations in 2450.
Okay.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to dismiss case 2450. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
All right, so now we're looking at 2451, and I think ultimately what we have to decide as a board, and unfortunately we've had quite a few of these recently, as to the responsibility of the responsible vet, and especially when you're dealing with a corporate practice or a practice where the responsible vet may not be the one actually making some of the policies and judgments and things like that. So I think that's what we have to discuss here. I think there was some confusion. I just wanted to point out a few things that I saw that have led me to lean one way or the other on this one. But there was narratives as well as commentary that we heard that he did get the letter, and then we heard from the complainant that he never received the letter and still hasn't received the letter. And there was this email referenced that he responded saying he had gotten the letter. And I don't see that in there. What I see in there is reference to a letter that says, I was informed that the appointment had been canceled via a letter. But I don't see that it ever says that they got the letter. So I just want to draw attention to that, because that kind of is a pertinent piece of where we're going with this case. So however you want to interpret that. I think there's also... at least looking at this case, this 2451 against a responsible veterinarian, you know, certainly there was some concern about whether antibiotics should have been provided, whether they could have gotten them in earlier, how they would have fit them into a schedule. It does seem like there were quite a few times where the owner was called and not worked into the schedule. So I have August 21st, there was a call. 8/24 was when the pictures were sent in, and still no antibiotics or appointments given. And then on the 26th, was offered to work in an appointment, but again, no antibiotics. I'm just pointing out some of the key facts. So I think now what we have to decide is whether the communication on this falls below the standard of 5011. And if it does it fall on the responsible veterinarian for a practice that is corporate? And when I went back to the responsible veterinarian definition, you know, obviously it's ensuring the premises complies with the laws and rules of the state and is responsible for the establishment of policy. But when you're looking at R311-5011 for professional communication, I don't know if a responsible veterinarian can really be responsible for the communication of another party, right? Like, you can be responsible for the practices at the premise, but communication isn't really a policy. It's like, so I'm just kind of a little bit like, is that really a responsible veterinarian's duty? Certainly in this case, I have no problems firing clients, and I think even in the case we heard earlier, everyone has a right to decide who they want to serve. That's not what we're here to decide. I think this one was sent via a letter in an active case where there was an appointment scheduled that was probably going to come up before the person ever received the letter, and is that professionally acceptable?
Okay, and I think...
yes, a couple of issues. We have some conflicting testimony. In the investigative committee's report, it says that the committee discussed that the manager, who is not a licensed professional with the board, is making a unilateral decision that can impact the licensed professional. And then we heard testimony by Dr. Skinner that he approved that letter. I'm interested in knowing, number one, do we have anything, since we have the committee concluding that it wasn't approved by Dr. Skinner before the letter was written, that it was done unilaterally by the program manager. Secondly, I'd like to briefly read R311-5011 under ethical standards, number 5. a responsible veterinarian employed by a partnership, corporation, or individual that is not licensed by the board shall ensure that the veterinary judgment and responsibility of each veterinarian employed by the partnership, corporation, or individual is neither influenced nor controlled by the partnership, corporation, or individual to the detriment of an animal.
And I think that that's where the responsible vet with the corporations comes in. What I don't know is being responsible for the medical standards of upholding the medical standards of the profession with regards to the veterinarians that work there. If that extends its reach over into a policy that says an office manager can terminate a client but via letter, and if that was an acceptable practice, right? Like, that seems a little out of reach to me for the responsible vet. I don't like the way that's happened, but I just don't know that I feel like that falls to the responsible vet. Any commentary?
No. No,
and this is a tough one because we've been in this situation before with responsible vets. And yeah. Do you understand what being a responsible vet really means? And do any of us understand what it means?
Yeah.
I mean, and certainly we don't want to get to a point where we don't have people wanting to be responsible vets, right? Because that's going to cause us a real issue. But I feel like at some point... And maybe the next question should be, does everybody feel like terminating a client that is actively going through treatment via a letter alone, no phone call or email, is an appropriate practice?
Yeah.
Because I think that's really the crux of it.
That's the issue. Was this a case in progress? And we terminated.
Yeah, not everybody checks their mail either every...
No,
regularly, so that's
easily
that's
a week.
Right.
Well, and anytime I send something like this by mail, I do certify, so I know it's been received.
Right.
I mean, that's a good standard for a few extra dollars that'll ensure that.
Right. But I understand not calling the person because that can just invite, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it can go both
ways. Well, because I mean,
looking through the records
on the 21st, we offered an appointment, it was declined, and it seems like there was some frustration or anger or something. Again, that's only one side of it, not the other, but I mean, it does state that. So, I mean, sometimes it sounds like the phone calls just may not be fruitful.
Is anybody else concerned about the responsible veterinarian actually having some concern for the safety of his employees?
I mean, I think that that's a very valid reason to... fire a client. I don't know how else to say that. To terminate business relationships with a client. If you're concerned for that, for sure.
Yeah,
I think he has every right to do that. I think the clinic has every right. We have a statute that says you have the right to do that. That's not really what I'm in question about. What I'm in question about is whether it's okay to do it via a letter that was likely not going to get there before their next already scheduled appointment that we have documentation of, and clearly it didn't get there before that appointment because he showed up and was told he was terminated via a letter that he still says he never got, and we don't have proof that he got. I think terminating him is not my issue.
Right. So is it not a violation and a letter of concern?
Yes, that's not a violation, but a letter of concern.
Right, because there's nothing in the statute that says you must terminate that relationship via these means, right?
Yeah.
So they did terminate it. That was acceptable per the statute. It's just it probably, in the scheme of things, would be better done a different mode, and so maybe it's a letter of concern on how they approach those.
I would support that as well. Okay. So I will make a motion in the case of 2451 that we dismiss with no violations, but issue a letter of concern for the practice operations of canceling a client's business relationships via a letter when the animal is currently still under care, and the timing of that was impacting the follow-ups.
My one concern is the currently under care, because I have had to terminate clients under care, because I said just because there's something going on, especially, again, this is a dog that's hard to control, licking, that kind of stuff, but I always provide for, hey, I've spoken with this other doctor who will take the case over. So if you're going to terminate something while under care, you need to kind of arrange for that, in my opinion. So I don't know if there's better ways of wording that, because I don't want to say under care means you can't do it. It's just you have to, I think it raises the bar on how to do it, in my opinion.
And I don't, in my wording, if it went to that, that's not what I meant. What I meant is it was still under care, so terminating via a letter that was going to take days to arrive was not the right choice.
With an active standing
an email could have been something done, you know, or, you know, a certified letter, overnight letter, something that would ensure that you got it there in a timely manner before their next appointment and that you had sent the medical records for them to find care. Okay. I don't think we have to go as far as finding them care for them, but I think we do have to tell them that before their appointment.
No, I agree. Okay. I just want to make sure
that makes sense.
No, I think so. Yeah.
Annalise, do you have
So, like a letter of concern for canceling the business relationship in a timely fashion while the patient is under care to ensure continuity of care? If that makes sense? That's what I kind of got out of it.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. kind of basically not leaving them out to hang dry.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we're not going to continue care here, and we're going to give you time to kind of get this figured out at that point. But, like I said, just I want to make sure that we don't set any kind of standard of saying, hey, just because we're actively under care, that you cannot terminate a relationship. I just want to make sure there's not any kind of standard set that way by saying
And I remain concerned that, according to the investigative committee's report, that the decision to terminate was a unilateral one made by an unlicensed professional, an administrative professional.
If you listen, though, in the audio from this case from the investigative committee, the veterinarian did say that they are okay with their office manager making that decision, that they have, they're okay with that policy. So that's their decision. I can't tell them if they feel comfortable with that or not, but they said they were comfortable with that, so I'm not addressing that.
Personally,
you know what I mean?
I mean, delegating that appointment, I think, is okay. It's kind of like we delegate to the board staff to do certain things for us in our stead. We trust that they're going to do it the right way. I trusted my practice manager to make the correct decisions. She would always run stuff by me, but I would back her on those decisions, so ultimately we come back to the vet. Now, was that truly done? And hey, I sent this out, or what? And that's a question, but I mean, I would delegate that stuff to my manager, too.
Okay, guys, so shift the responsibility.
We've got to wrap this up here. So, so we have a motion. Was there, I think there was a second?
A second.
Okay. Motion and a second to issue a letter of concern in the case of 2451. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
Okay. Motion passes. Thank you all for being here today. We're going to keep going. If anybody just needs to step out for a bathroom break real quick, go ahead. Got enough. So we are now on number 13, 2461, in regards to Ariana Adams, DVM. If you'll read the front load, Annalise.
Case 2461, the complaint is Lisa Lay, the respondent is Ariana Adams, DVM. On November 1st, 2023, Sebastian, a 16-year-old male domestic short hair, was presented to respondent for urinating on himself and outside the litter box, weight loss, and lethargy. Urine cannot be collected. Blood work revealed hyperglycemia, leukocytosis, and other mild changes. Due to the cat's history of stressful environmental changes and urinary issues, respondent wanted to get the stress and infection under control and refer the pet owner back to the primary care veterinarian to address the hyperglycemia. The cat was administered buprenorphine and sirenia and was discharged. The following day, the cat was presented to Arizona Animal Wellness Center for evaluation. The cat had dolmentation and was dehydrated, therefore was started on IV fluids. Since the premises did not have regular insulin, the cat was transferred to an emergency facility for continued care and diabetes management. The cat was transferred to Arizona Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care Center for stabilization and diabetes management for diabetes mellitus and DKA. On November 3rd, 2023, the cat was discharged with a Freestyle Libre, sub-Q fluids, and Lantus insulin. The committee concluded that possible violations of the Veterinary Practice Act occurred. It was moved and seconded that the board, ARS 3222-3222, medical incompetence, lacking sufficient medical knowledge or skill, or both, to a degree likely to endanger the health of the patient, failure to treat and make recommendations for care of a diabetic patient, which could have led to the death of the patient. The motion was approved with a vote of 3-0.
Okay, thank you. And we do not have the complainant here. However, we do have Dr. Adams and Dave Stoll representing.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, thank you for being here, Dr. Adams, and I can give you up to 5 minutes to address the board.
My name is Ariana Adams, and I'm a proud member of the first graduating class of the University of Arizona College of Veterinary Medicine. When my license was issued less than 7 months ago, I never dreamed that I would have to appear before you to defend my license. On November 1st of last year, I was practicing as an emergency intern at the Gilbert Queen Creek Emergency Veterinarian and Specialty Center when I was presented with mislaid cats and Sebastian. The presenting complaint was hematuria and urinating outside the litter box, with concern due to his long history of urinary issues. According to Ms. Lake, Sebastian was eating and drinking at the time of presentation. Sebastian was not brought in by Ms. Lake, however, she was on her mother's speakerphone throughout the appointment. After performing an appropriate physical exam, in which Sebastian did not appear to be dehydrated, I placed an ultrasound probe on his bladder to confirm that it was completely empty and collapsed on itself. I then reassured Ms. Lake that he was not blocked, which was her primary concern. During my discussions with Ms. Lake and her mother, I was made aware that Sebastian had recently moved and was now in a new home with other cats. As a result, he had not been eating his prescription urine diet solely, and he would frequently get into other cats' food. The owners also advised that they had recently stopped giving Sebastian his gabapentin. I offered to send out a blood panel that would include a CBC chemistry, T4, and fructosamine so that we could get a more in-depth look at his overall health. Instead, Ms. Lake opted for an in-house CBC and chemistry so that we could evaluate the liver and kidneys and glucose values. I also offered an in-house urine analysis. Ms. Lake declined and would only authorize the in-house blood testing, which demonstrated a mild leukocytosis with neutrophilia, and the chemistry showed a mildly elevated BUN, hyperglycemia, and mild hypercholesterolemia. As I stated in my response, I did not ignore the potential blood chemistry values that could be consistent with diabetes and recommended a ketone check on a blood sample to give us a better idea as to whether Sebastian was experiencing decay. The test was performed and the blood ketone level 1.9 indicated he was not experiencing decay at this time. I conferred this information with a colleague and consulted a reference text. As a result, I elected conservative treatment for a potential UTI with secondary stress hyperglycemia, with a recommendation for a follow-up appointment with her regular veterinarian to confirm his resolution or persistent hyperglycemia and subsequent treatment options. I know that they say hindsight is 20/20, and although I believe I have started down the path toward the treatment of Sebastian's subsequently confirmed diabetes, I can visualize in retrospect I could have been more aggressive in that regard. I could have made a more persuasive recommendation to hospitalize and obtain a urinary sample and confirm or deny a potential UTI causing hypoglycemia versus true diabetes. In any event, I do not feel the care that I provided in this case rose to the level of violation or that I need additional education in the field of feline diabetes, and so perhaps a letter of concern is warranted in this case. Regardless of your decision here today, I intend to use this experience as a teaching moment in my young career and will be more persuasive in my recommendations for diagnostics and therapy in the future. Thank you.
I would just like to echo what Dr. Adams said, that this is probably a case in which a letter of concern would be the most appropriate to the course of action. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both. You may step back.
Actually, before you step back, I had a couple of questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
So you'd say that you're an intern at the time?
Yes, I'm still currently an intern.
Okay. Did you, you had a supervising doctor, you ran this case by someone?
Correct.
Who was that, or am I allowed to ask that, I guess?
I'm
serious. Okay, yeah, so were they directly in, at the hospital? Was this a phone call thing, or how did you run that by your supervising doctor?
She was on shift with me at the time at the ER. After getting the blood work results, I did speak to her about possible DKA, so she recommended the ketone check, and then we consulted a reference text together to confirm that his level warranted that he was not in DKA, and per the text, a level of 2.4 or higher in cats was considered. So she said we considered that since cats can frequently go into remission with insulin treatment, that it would be safe and be more conservative to treat any underlying stress and other issues before just putting a cat on insulin.
What was the discussion around the glucose level at that point? Was that suspected to be stress-related? Was it suspected to be diabetes at that point? Or what was, at 531, what was the suspicion?
Yeah, so we discussed the possibility of both, and I discussed both with Ms. Lake at the time as well. But just to be safe, before just putting her cat on insulin, and I did discuss that, we wanted to control stress due to all the recent changes in the home, his urinary issues, her taking off his chronic gabapentin use that he had for arthritis and stress in general, and then rechecking to make sure that that hyperglycemia was true.
And that was concurred by the supervising veterinarian?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Nosley, you are the lead on this one.
Okay, thank you. A very unfortunate situation. We've got a recently graduated veterinarian doing an internship who finds herself as one of two doctors doing an ER shift. And obviously, very busy ER based on its location. The key issue is the patient came in and was part of the initial workup. Was determined to have a blood glucose of 531. The description of the presenting complaint is totally different from the complainant versus the respondent. The complainant said severe PDPU, weight loss, neurological signs. The respondent said inappropriate urination, hematuria. According to the record, the respondent did receive the information about the PDPU and weight loss. So this issue of the blood test for ketones and determining the cat wasn't in DKA, well, if you have a blood glucose of 531, maybe by that strip you're not in DKA, but you're going to be real soon. So I don't think that was an appropriate test to rule out DKA and make a recommendation to recheck in 1 to 2 weeks on the glucose levels. Other concerns, the respondent said the patient did not appear to be dehydrated, yet the next day at another clinic, fortunately the cat was taken to another clinic, was profoundly dehydrated and immediately put on IV fluid. The respondent wanted to do outside lab work, but I think that's because we had a different focus on what was going on. But the blood glucose of 531 pretty much trumps everything in this case. The respondent making the determination that the blood glucose of 531 was likely due to stress in this case, and then advising waiting 1 to 2 weeks to get rid of that stress and then recheck is not appropriate with a blood glucose of 531. I think the respondent was more focused on the history of this longstanding UTI hematuria. Glucose and stress, I think most veterinarians kind of use a blood glucose number somewhere around 250 as a point where we're not going to consider stress anymore, and diabetes mellitus is right at the top of our list. What's more important, though, than the actual number, whether you're deciding this is stress or not, is there PDPU and weight loss? And if there is, that pretty much eliminates stress as a cause for your glucose elevation, regardless of the number. And if the respondent was concerned about diabetes mellitus but thought the rise was due to stress, could have at least sent in a fructosamine during that 1 to 2 week period we were waiting. I was glad to hear that the respondent did some consulted a reference. That was one of my concerns. It's very simple in today's world to consult a reference. It's on our phone. And if you Google cat 531 glucose, could this be stress, you got your answer there. So I was glad that, but I think the focus then was on this ketone test. So in this case, I would agree with the investigative committee and find the violation cited. And I would make a motion to accept that.
Well, I had some comments on this too. Yeah, I agree that when we see 531, I mean, stress is out. That's well beyond that. The workup itself seemed to be very good. I mean, the initial diagnostics, all this, I think the medicine was very good there. It's the interpretation is the problem. I don't disagree that the cat was not in DK at that point. I mean, we did a test, we were negative on there. But this was also done at around 8 o'clock in the evening, and we present the next day. I can see that the cat would have been more fine at that point, and then worse the next day, because when you have a high glucose like that, the first thing that's going to happen is a physiologic diuresis. You're going to just start dehydrating yourself to just pee that out as much as possible. If you're not taking in enough fluids to compensate for that, I can see us becoming a raisin overnight. So I can see that there's definitely discrepancy in kind of that time frame, but I don't see that as out of the bounds of medicine. My major concern is, and this is something that's been a concern for me for a while, so maybe my perception's colored, but we have an intern who is still in a training and a learning phase, and we turn these new veterinarians loose without proper justification. So without proper backup in kind of the consulting now, I do like the fact that we went to another doctor, a more experienced doctor, and consulted and kind of got this, but my more concern is that more experienced doctor missed this also.
Yeah.
That is a big thing, and now we have this new veterinarian who is deferring to his more experienced veterinarian saying, this is stress, let's not deal with that. I can definitely see on emergency, you don't want to start a diabetic case. I mean, diabetes is one of the nightmares for us in day practice too. It is not fun to deal with. It's very, very difficult. And especially in just those short few hours that you're in emergency, that's not an easy thing to start. Let's start insulin and then go to your doctor, because all of a sudden you start insulin, the cat's doing better, they never go recheck, they just keep going, and now you have problems 6 weeks later as opposed to now. But my major concern is that I'm a little concerned that this supervising doctor kind of dissuaded this intern who's less experienced in saying, oh, this is stress, we'll just pass it off to a DVM tomorrow. So I'm a little leery on, was this more a judgment failure of the respondent, or was this, we're going to push that off to our DVM and kind of going along with it?
I struggle with that too, because obviously the type of work I work in is often very financially limited, so that's not the case here, but in many cases it is. And so you're asking veterinarians to make judgment on cases based on experience because you don't have the finances to do the testing. And we see that a lot where, okay, now you're dependent on experience. How is somebody that got out of school 7 months ago gonna ever have that experience to make that judgment call? Like, I would hope that we would teach in our classes that a 531 glucose or whatever it was is serious. But if they're asking for support and they've referenced other people and they're 7 months out, like, there's no way for them to have 20 years of experience when they get out of school and seven months ago. There's just no way. So where do we draw the line on holding somebody accountable for the knowledge of having 20 years of experience when they can't possibly have that knowledge? There's just no way.
But I think to Dr. Nosley's point, I mean, you could Google a 531 and a cat glucose and get an idea, right?
Yeah, but
I mean,
you can Google and get a lot of shit that you don't want
to
get.
But if we wanted to talk about a resource for veterinarians, then we have specific resources for veterinarians. I mean, I didn't do an internship. I went right into practice. And so you had to figure out those things. And thank goodness there was Vin when I graduated. So, but, you know, so, yes, I hear you. We have internships. We have doctors that we ask opinions, but there's times that we're going to disagree with those opinions, and we also don't know how that case was presented to the lead veterinarian. Yeah, he's got some hyperglycemia, but I think it might be stress. I was going to check ketones. Do you think that's a good idea? Mm-hmm. Sure. Like, if that's the information that I got, I'd be like, yeah, let's do that while I'm trying to manage other cases. Was there actually communication that said, these are exactly the labs, can you give me, you know? So I think we need to kind of...
Well, and I'm not saying I would want to open a case or go any further on the other veterinarian, right? We don't know that. What I would say is there has to be some level of judgment when we're evaluating somebody who's been out 7 months versus somebody with 20 years of experience. And we cannot, all of us collectively, cannot apply our 20 years of experience to establishing the standard of care. Because there are veterinarians that will not have our experience until they've been out 20 years.
Well, like, especially we see hospitals using interns as, I don't want to say real doctors, that sounds horrible, but I mean as actual full-time doctors because it's cheaper. And an internship, in my opinion, is it's a full training program. Intern should be a training program. If you're dealing with this, if you're having a less compensated doctor, they should be very well trained and very well supervised. That's the point of an internship. If you're using it as another doctor and just kind of turning them loose, that's a little more frightening for me. And internships are unregulated in our industry. The only regulation is residencies. So anybody can start an internship. So there's no standards to hold to. So I'm very, very leery about a medical incompetence case in determination right now based on we're in a training, we deferred to another doctor that was more experienced, and
I don't think we should get hung up on
But it's very true, and it's something
whenever you're a licensed professional in this state, mm-hmm. once you carry a license, you follow our statutes. So, here's the thing, is if you're a brand new baby veterinarian or a brand new baby CBT, you're not held to a different standard to 20 years or 30 years experience, right? So there's that. Internships and residencies are not regulated by the board. They just aren't. Never will be in the foreseeable future, at least that we know, right? Because that's by lawmakers. The thing is that what you're looking at is what this complaint is that this person feels like they didn't get what they went in for. The thought is this person very much advocated for their pet. Mistakes happen. It doesn't mean they were intentional. It doesn't mean that 7 months out of school or 17 years out of school that these things don't happen. So you can't apply it differently just because it's 7 months or 7 years.
But how you look at results, it's very different your first year out than it is
our statutes don't apply differently. Right. The standard of care is very different. And so
we apply the standard of care to 20 years of experience. Yeah. We do this often.
But then you would have to post to the public, hi, I'm a new grad that's been out for 2 days and I have my license.
I think
right?
that should be.
Okay, but that's not a statute. But
no, it's not a statute, but it's part of the standard of care, in my opinion, because the standard of care is not fully defined.
Okay, let's make sure we're trying to stay on
path
here.
We can't look at the veterinarian's experience in every case on here and draw a line and say we're going to not find a violation here because we're inexperienced. It's just exactly, unfortunately, it's exactly what it says. You're a licensed veterinarian, whether we call you an intern or whatever we want to call you. That's the issue within the clinic.
My point is just to say, let's all check ourselves occasionally and say, are we making the standard of care something that a new grad would foreseeably know from their education and should they have known, or are we applying our 20 years of experience to that and making the standard of care something it shouldn't be? That's my point in this. Everybody's going to have a different decision on that.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is that we cannot apply 20 years of experience to the standard of care. That cannot be the standard of care, because then how would you ever get a new grad from day one to 20 years of experience?
In my case, 20 years isn't any.
I wasn't quite reaching out.
Madam Chair.
My opinion on standard of care is that...
It's the minimum standard of care, I understand legally. So it's not the 20-year experience standard of care that we enforce.
But we can't
it's
have a
minimum.
Sliding scale.
Okay.
I agree with everything we're saying in this stuff, but this really, it's important because this is going to, in terms of if we find a violation, how we handle it.
Can you remind me what your violation...
Exactly for? What the, yeah. If I need to repeat it from the investigative committee, should I?
No.
Okay.
No, I answered, I was ready for the record.
Exactly what they were going to ask for.
Unfortunately, yes. Okay, so we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Can I just ask, are you thinking of offering a consent agreement?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second to find a violation. There's no further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
Cool. Is that two nays?
Two.
Okay. So motion passes.
Okay. So in this case, a consent agreement. As to the findings of fact, there's one error in the findings of fact that a second was made by Mr. Bennett, he's listed as Dr. Bennett, and I think we have to be accurate. Who knows who's looking at these things? It's pretty minor, but I think.
Thank you.
Okay. So I would make a motion to accept the amended findings of fact and changing the Dr. Bennett to Mr. Bennett.
Okay. I'll second that. Should we do roll call, Mark?
Yes, please.